Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And we are returning from an unexpected break. Had a tragedy in the family. My mom passed away on January 16th, and that happened to be one of our recording days. And so since we record two episodes a day, we missed two whole weeks. But we wouldn't have recorded anything anyway, because that day was a rough day.
Yes.
In the life of us. And then the week after, the 7 days after that 7 day mark was also rough. As we were preparing for the funeral and our services, which were great. But I wanted to thank everyone who sent thoughts and prayers and wishes and food and gifts and flowers and all of that, because that was huge. I didn't realize how much I needed it until I had it, and if I didn't have it, I would be a lot worse off. So thank you all. Yeah, it's gonna be it's still a little rough, but we're here to get moving. All right, so it is officially Black History Month, and we are black. So let's talk about some Black History stuff. I don't know. How do you generally feel about it? Is this a big deal for you?
Not necessarily. I think Black History Month when I was in school was a big deal because it was something to look forward to. But now I'm celebratory all the time.
You blacken it up every month.
Yeah.
All right. So one of the cool things about Black History Month is the people who are here, the black people that are here.
Mm-hmm.
Survived a lot of things.
Yes.
And not just us, but especially our ancestors who survived a ton of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that line in the movie Black Panther where Killmonger was saying,
"Bury me in the ocean, like my ancestors who knew it was better to die than to live in bondage," or something to that effect.
Yes, and those ancestors would not be his ancestors because died in the ocean.
But it's okay.
They're not the survivors.
I understand.
He's a child of a survivor. Well, he's a fictional character, but
right.
He would be the child of a survivor just like all of us who mm-hmm. survived the Middle Passage, who survived slavery and all of its machinations. Survived Jim Crow and mm-hmm. black codes, and now we're surviving mass incarceration and we're still here. So
still here.
We got a lot of people to talk about. And so who are some of your lesser known black people the black heroes?
Lesser knowns.
So we know that people want to be talking about Martin Luther King a lot.
I mean, yeah. And basically misstating everything that this man was about.
Right.
And giving a lot of credit to, I guess you end up giving a lot of attention and credit to people who have made it above the din of, you know, there are blacks living, thriving, surviving in America. So you have your King, you have your Garvey, you have your Malcolm X, and all that's 20th century. You have your Nat Turners, if you celebrate that.
Angela Davis.
Yeah, Denmark Vesey, and all of this stuff. But I think that your lesser knowns are people who, because what they did was probably downplayed in its time, they end up not making those headlines. They end up not being the people that you know, put a star next to their name. But I'm more interested in, like, they're not nameless. They're definitely not faceless. Right. But I feel like the heroes are the children who actually, you know, desegregated their schools. We talk about the Little Rock Nine. I think his name is James Meredith, who desegregated University of Mississippi. Like, you know certain names.
Yeah.
But all of the schools had to go through this process. You know, shout out to the kids who took the lead in doing that.
Right.
You know, when you talk about lesser knowns, people know about the major marches, like the March to Selma or the March on Washington, but a lot of people don't know that there was a children's march in Birmingham, Alabama. Like, yeah. Our kids lead, you know, sometimes we putting kids on the front lines or putting kids in I don't want to say it like this, it's gonna sound crazy, but like letting kids lead, even if it's a precarious situation, is something that has been done over history, because it's almost like a human inclination to not hurt children.
Yeah.
And they appear to be very innocent when they are carrying, you know, the banner. This, like, why would you shoot the child? Why would you hurt the child? Movements in Black America have not been any different. Our kids tend to lead us, you know, fearlessly, because they don't have the experience that sometimes adults have of those things incurring some sort of punishment or incurring some sort of pain. So if I had to, you know, think about anybody, it'd be, you know, those children who did those things. Like, even on Solange's album, part of her outtakes were her parents talking about their experiences growing up. So Matthew Knowles, who we not heard a lot from, actually talked about his experience having to go to a newly desegregated school under what he felt was threat of his life. Mm-hmm. You know, so more so than I thank him for giving me Beyonce, because that's how I feel about her, I also can look at him like, you know, thank you for doing that, and thank you for being able to articulate your experience, because it wasn't without trauma. I mean, he's, regardless of the things he's done, I know that he has also tried to shine a light on, he's always been put in a position, or felt like he was in a position, to fight for something greater than him. And it wasn't until I heard this articulation of, I was going to elementary school fearful for my life because, you know, Klan's people were actively and openly threatening, you know, right, me and these other children. That those are the people that I'm like, yo.
Yeah, those kids in that Birmingham march, that was a strategic decision by the part of leadership to put them up front. And it wasn't without the consent of those kids. Those kids were ready to be on the front lines.
And they went to jail. They said, oh, it's time to go to jail.
And it was also contested decision because people didn't want them on the front lines. Mm-hmm. And Martin was like, well, no, we got to show all of this. And that ended up being what was captured on video for the rest of the nation to see, where police are actually sicking dogs and hoses and beating children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunately one of those things that had to be seen. I mean, you had a group of kids who were ready and
who were brilliant. They weren't just robots.
Right.
They were smart. One of those children is a university president in our state. And when he tells his story, you wouldn't.
Who is this?
Hrabowski.
Ah.
Yeah. Okay. So Dr. Hrabowski from the University of Maryland system, when you hear him speak, he speaks of his time being active in the civil rights movement. But he was also a young mathematician. He was a genius. So he did that, I think, around the age of 12 or 13. And then he went to Hampton University. So these kids became something. And he's just the first example that came to my mind. Like, you go hear him talk, and you want to hear him talk about what UMBC has become, he's going to take you all the way back to this time where he was trying to fight for his right to become as great as he felt like he could be.
Yeah, one of those people who actually worked to channel the energy of those young people was Ella Baker. She was a little bit older than them, but she came out of Shaw University as valedictorian and worked for the NAACP, and so through those connections she started another organization and then ended up co-founding SNCC. And we hear a lot about John Lewis from SNCC, but Ella Baker was really behind the scenes making sure this actually runs. And that's unfortunately the position that a lot of Black women were relegated to, was behind the scenes. But she wasn't just like, it's not like you in the kitchen cooking green beans. Like, she was actually arguing all the time with Martin about like, look, this is what we need to be doing. And so when she was mentoring and helping lead SNCC, those are the group of kids that she's actually leading and directing and helping channel that energy into something constructive and useful. And that ends up being the major civil rights organization that it is.
Mm-hmm.
We talk a lot about Rosa Parks, but we don't talk a lot about Claudette Colvin, who was the 15-year-old who in 1955 refused to give up her seat on a bus.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was dragged off the bus and arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why Rosa ended up in the position she was because the civil rights leaders, Martin at that time, the rest of those people with him, saw Claudette and was like, this is what they're doing. but we can't really put her up as the face. She's 15. She's not married. She's pregnant. Mm-hmm. So we need somebody else
who fits
the actual narrative that we're trying to tell.
Boo.
Right. And so that ended up being Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. And so Claudette Colvin is one of those people who just you don't really hear too much about. Mm-hmm. But she's the younger of the two, and she risked a lot to do that. I mean, mm-hmm. and then also Irene Kirkcaldy. She was 1944, I believe. Yeah, she did the same thing. So she refused to give up her seat. She was arrested and actually took her case with the help of Thurgood Marshall and some of the other civil rights attorneys, took that to the Supreme Court and won her case, mm-hmm. which was later ignored by everyone else. And so this, even though the Supreme Court had ruled in her favor that she should not have to give up her seat, the South didn't care, as the South chose frequently to shirk the rulings of the Supreme Court mm-hmm. through education and things like that. But mm-hmm. if you're looking for like unsung
hero. Black history, you're going to find them.
A lot. And a lot of them are going to be women, because what we typically tend to put up are the men.
Yes.
As if the women are not there doing all of the same work.
And while we're, you know, at it, just thinking about Bayard Rustin, who doesn't always get his just due mm-hmm. for being an integral part of the movement, the civil rights movement in the mid 20th century. And that was, again, orchestrated because he didn't fit this particular cookie cutter image of what would be acceptable, because he was a black gay man mm-hmm. and living in his truth and side by side doing the strategizing and is present in every picture just about. Yeah. And when you see Dr. King flanked with his inner sanctum, you see this man, but he's not always highlighted for what he actually contributed and brought to the table. But while we're talking about the women, I think now we're in a position and a posture where we are used to being more inclusive, looking out at the margins and saying, no, I want to talk about you. I want to bring you in. I want to talk about, you know, people who have been ignored. So while we're throwing up names, we can throw his up, even yeah. though some people are more familiar now. But he is, I don't think you can look at what was accomplished at that time and withhold from him. And you got to understand, even though James Baldwin is someone else who's prominent, who people understand, also lived very openly as a black gay man, I believe that Baldwin's appearance and his presence within the arts, if you will, kind of separated him or somehow buffered how people looked at that, like, mm-hmm. oh, you know, he's eccentric, or any term that you yeah. would want to put there to minimize him. But I also think that his lane was for himself, because he wrote his truth
yeah.
as opposed to being seen as a part of this bigger administration of this movement.
So black culture is full of these heroes, sung and unsung, but we mm-hmm. are also a culture that has resilience as its hallmark. And we have at times and continue to figure out ways to survive and develop hone our survival skills in a world of white supremacy that does not want to see us live.
It's not funny.
Yeah, but it's a real thing.
But, yeah, it's like Pinky in the Brain. Like, every day, y'all trying to destroy us. And every day, we be like, mm-hmm.
We still here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about survival skills. Black History Month. What's the number one thing you need to know as a black person to survive in this? The number one tool you need to have in your toolkit.
I feel like my number one tool has been, okay, so your number one tool, shoot, like things you do or things you believe? Okay, things you do. I feel like my code switch is integral to how I navigate this system. And it started, you know, I didn't even know that this was a thing. But when I was younger, I remember being on the phone with somebody and they were like, you sound like a white girl on the phone. I was like, what? And I don't think they meant it to be a compliment, nor did I take it as one, mm-hmm. but there was such a thing where, like, well, I would observe adults around me switch their phone voice depending on who they're calling and what they're calling for. As I grew up, I realized that this was so that they would be treated a certain type of way, even over the phone. It's not just over the phone. It's face to face. It's in every interaction, every transaction. It could pop up. Sometimes it pops up between us, and I'm like, is this also coded? Like, I too have a white woman's voice on the phone. But yeah, my code switch is integral to what I do.
Yeah, it's interesting to have something that you take pride in, but you know you don't want to do. You just have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that when I let my hair down and I'm not, it's not about overcompensating or being, or lacking, I don't know, being genuine rather, but there's a difference.
Yeah, and I think the fact that it is a survival skill is where that pride comes from, because here you are in 2019 and you have survived because of this thing that you've had to learn to do. And that's just one of those unfortunate realities. I mean, we black people have many mechanisms to help us navigate this this morass of danger that we wake up to every day. But yeah, I would definitely say code switch is like the huge
it's
one.
It's a huge thing.
We also are really good at building, like, safe communities. Like, we, whether that community is like church or sorority or fraternity or club or community hub, like a salon or a barbershop, like we,
or just little informal groups.
Yeah.
Sisterhood, talking about sisterhood, the presence of, you know, the equal and opposite, a brotherhood, whether they're formal or not. You know, as a sorority member, there's that. And then there's, like, what I do with my homegirls, too, that kind of helps revitalize us, because it's harsh. It can be harsh out here, you know, and things are actually getting better. They're getting so good now that I'm going back and thinking, like, yo, that was really bad, as far as, like, even images, you know, like, now we're in a place where we can celebrate our body types and our skin color and our hair textures. And I remember every commercial trying to get you to get a perm, or every woman who was, you know, highly desired in a video was light skin with the same ashy brown weave. And I'm talking about, and either you fit that or you don't, you know, as a darker hued person. Some of that is colorism, but some of that is also the powers that be choosing what images we consume. So we're getting better, but by no means. I mean, we're not all the way there yet, but we're like the twerk video that came out. Some people had an issue.
Which twerk video is this?
It's called Twerk. It's,
oh, you're talking Cardi about the City Girls. City Girls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I didn't really have expectations.
I thought I missed something. No. I was like, wait a minute. Where am I?
Hundreds of women got flued out. So I know, but the end result of that video, like, yeah, it was extra. It was a lot, but it was also like this very woman-centered, blocked out space for us to just, I mean, you just feel like shaking off sometimes. That's how I took it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And visually, one of the first things, of course, it takes no time for think pieces to come out, but one of the first things I noticed was, like, there's not a man here. There's not, you know, there's no other energy here except for these are dancers and they are dancing. I was like, okay, that's fine.
It's weird, like, people act like, you know, certain parts of your body are not supposed to shake when you dance. Like, that's just part of dancing. What am I supposed to sit there and just play hand bone on my knees or something? Like, this is stupid. Like, I gotta actually move. You have to move yourself to dance. Right. And so, you know, if you got more to move, then more of you is going to move.
But yeah, that's just an example, like, these images, as far as, like, when you say building safe community, I think that what we do inside our homes can be very, very beautiful, you know, especially if you open it up for somebody else to observe that. Like, my family, we have an open door policy during the holidays, and I never get tired of hearing people say, oh my God, like, your family is so loving. They are so, you know, I don't know, warm. And I'm like, yeah, okay. But I also know that that is some, that's our buffer against whatever's going on outside that door. So I might not have understood all of our ritual and all of our stuff, but I get it now because it's restorative. It revitalizes.
That's one of the tools that's a holdover from our forced separation during slavery. So another tool that blacks in America have is the extended family and the way we extend our families.
Everybody's a cousin.
We all cousins. It's the same. Like, I mean, and that starts when, you know, your family is broken up on a slave block and your children go somewhere else and someone else's children are coming to you and they don't have anyone. And so someone has to take care of that that person. Someone has to look out for them.
Extend mothering.
Right. And they don't have any way to get back to their family. Like your children don't come back to you, or maybe your spouse doesn't come back to you. And so your family just becomes who's around.
Yeah.
And that is a beautiful celebration of culture. I mean, it comes from an ugly place of being forced. No one should have to. We're looking at children separated from their families at the border right now, knowing that that's something that we went through. But that's how we kind of managed through that. I mean, you just show up with a whole new family. And I
think it's something that people who have to interact with such a structure that is so hell-bent on breaking things, you try to figure out a way to heal from that. So, you know, some people will, you know, say, oh, love is the key, love is the answer. But like that type of loving, like if you can even do this with animals, and I'm not trying to make that comparison, but like when you lose something, if you try to replace the same source, right? So like you said, imagine that, children being separated from their mother, going to a place where a mother has been separated from their children. That's like a powerful exchange of love that would not be able to happen if not for the tragedy that, you know, precipitated it. But, you know, the only upside that I've seen for people processing what is happening at the border is that it adds some foundational understanding to what we've been saying for years happened to us. You know, so now when the think pieces come out and say, oh, we know that this could be traumatic for the rest of their lives, or we know that, you know, it only takes 21 days to begin to forget things, whatever these researchers are saying, I'm like, and that happened to us, and now you need to look at how these things can be overcome. You know, because I do think that when you study community, you will see that we are experts at making something out of nothing.
When I see that those children separated, I wonder the impact that has on your identity. So when black people were brought over here, we were forcibly removed from our cultural roots. And that effort was ongoing as we had to fight to interject things. And we're going to talk about this in the next episode when we're talking about black faith in America. But we had to find different ways to retain that culture. And that initiated an identity struggle because you don't know where you're coming from. You don't have access to that information. And then the families that you do have here, you don't have ties to them. And so when I look at, you know, just some of the things we do, I wonder how much of it is that cry for identity, or that trying to figure out like, you know, that flash that, you know what I'm saying, basketball player has, or, you know, like where everyone else is doing fundamentals and I'm crossing you up because I just want to make sure that you see what I'm doing out here. Like all of that is like, look at me, like I am me, I am here, I'm important and I matter. Which is another way, I mean, it could be sad, but I actually think that it kind of defines like one of the things that we are. Like, we're going to be there because, you know, trying to erase us is not going to work.
That's not working.
Because we showing up and we here. So you just got to deal with us. Another tool that I really do love about the black community is the retention of our griot culture.
Yes.
So the African griot was
The storyteller. This is my line name, so I mean, I'm excited. Go ahead.
So it wasn't. I mean, they were also musicians, some of them, but they really did. They were entrusted with the histories and the current events of what was going on at the time, and actually getting the griots were the internet for African culture, and we see that now. I mean, we've still retained that. So, like, if I mean, I'm bald now, but I'll still go get my beard done at the barbershop, and I see that griot come in there and telling, you know, what's going on, what's that, and that's a beautiful part. That makes the whole experience. And so the fact that we do this in different ways through some of our music and things like that, that retention is important, and I love that we do that.
Well, even our artistic expression, if you take that one step further, that griot culture spawned an artistic expression, or culture of artistic expression, where there were messages hidden in even what we were saying and what we were doing. So it's not just how we style our hair. It's understanding that once upon a time, your hair was a map. And when you really get into that, when you really get into somebody, just the whole idea, at least for people who used to sit for cornrows, you know, this wasn't always a formal experience. I'm going to go to the African braiding gallery and go have somebody do my hair. You'd be sitting on the porch, you'd be sitting in a chair or something between somebody's legs and letting them, you know, style your hair. But imagine somebody taking the time and styling your hair in a way that someone else could look at it and be like, we're headed there. This is what it looks like. This is where we're going. You know, that doing it in your hair is, I don't know, like, it's just the height of artistic genius to me, because you're talking about, like, some people can't even part hair straight. Like, it's, this could be a struggle. But not only that, but like even designing quilts and letting quilts tell the story. When I put these patches together and I drape this quilt over this fencing, you not only know that this is where you're not supposed to stop, but I'm giving you the tools to get where you're going. You know, when I sing a song, the birth of our, you know, gospel music is actually songs designed to move you from one physical place to the other, while also probably moving you from a mental state to another, right? From hopelessness to hopefulness, that this will not kill you because I'm singing you from bondage to freedom.
So yeah, that famous example is Swing Low Sweet Chariot, which is a song on its surface which appears to be about heaven and that person being carried off to heaven, but it's really telling people, communicating to them, hey, listen, Underground Railroad is happening. This is where you need to be.
It's going down.
So just be ready, it's coming for you. You know what I'm saying? So that kind of is one of the ways that we've adapted and ended up thriving in a culture of suffering, or that would try to impose suffering. Music is huge.
Huge. Our call and response culture, call and response in African rooted music is again about the guide and the follower. And it has not gone anywhere in our area. Go-go music is integral to our local culture.
Oh God, yes.
But to watch the documentaries that tell us that these drums and this drumming culture is a direct tie back to African roots that we celebrate, even if we did not directly participate in, you know, whatever nation or wherever. It's like these are unbreakable bonds. So that means that upon arrival and having an opportunity to design, I designed a drum. And I designed a drum that reminded me of the drums that I used to hear, that used to tell us things. And I kept that drumming culture. I kept that drumming up. In New Orleans, the drumming was so integral to the fact that Africans under that particular system had a day of rest on Sundays. They would gather in a place called Congo Square with their drums and their singing and their music making. And, you know, whites were like, I don't know what the slaves are doing. We don't go down there. We don't bother them. But because they did not bother them, a subculture grew out of that that is so strong in New Orleans that it's one of my favorite places to be. It's one of the most Africanized places in the United States. Yeah. And when you're there, and when you're reading about their history from their perspective, you realize that the drumming kept them directly tied to Haiti, kept them directly tied to Cuba. And these are societies now that we see as deeply rooted in their Africanness, you know, regardless of what colonialism and other forces have tried to do to them, especially Haiti, trying to crush them on the aftermath of them winning their freedom via the revolution. That changed the whole entire trade history, economic history of our country and the Caribbean. But what is consistent with all of that, what's consistent regardless of what the politics did, is the drumming, the singing, the dancing, and the messaging. The idea that we had, you know, and like we said, we're going to get into this, but even our African rooted spiritualities and religious acknowledgments survived.
Yeah, so yeah, we're gonna save that for the next show, because I really got some detail about what we're gonna do. But so let's talk about
our food.
Yes, let's talk about our food.
Our food, again, making something out of nothing. Now everybody loves our something.
What is our something?
I don't know, because I don't eat chitlins or
pig feet. I don't eat chitlins, no,
you don't eat a lot of stuff, but
plant-based life. Yeah, just
you don't eat a lot of things, but I think our cooking methods, our respect for, you know, farm to table is very like nouveau, like very what is it? Current, for lack of a better term, like, oh, farm to table. But for many years, that's how we lived. Mm-hmm. It was from the farm to the table. And I think that we use our food and our abilities around food to create community.
Yeah, and flavor.
A lot of flavor.
Yeah. Thank you again for bringing that food over last week.
You're welcome.
It was action-packed with flavor. And I just love, you know what I'm saying? I love eating good food.
And I love to make
it's some. A community thing. I mean, even if it we're is. Just sitting around eating crabs, that's like, you know, that's just what we
that
do.
That is an event. Do y'all want to get some crabs?
I know, that's the thing. Yeah, what you doing today? I'm getting some crabs.
Oh.
That's the whole day.
Yeah, let me get six of them.
Everyone's not listening to this from Maryland. But that's it's just okay. Something that we
when
do.
When y'all come, this is something that, yeah.
Yeah, you pay your $100-something, get you a bushel of crabs, and then you just sit around, play spades, you know, listen to music, and pick crabs.
And enjoy your day.
All right, so we thriving now. We've survived. Now, as Black history continues to evolve, because, you know,
every day
what happened yesterday was history. So what are we adding to the culture?
Everything. We won't take credit for everything, but I think we are the flavor to anything that America has going on. Anything that any of these Western civilizations have going on, when it flows through our filter, it just turns into something different. Invitation being the highest form of flattery, we haven't come up with something that hasn't been seen as worthy of not imitating.
Yeah, I think one of the major places where you can see that influence is in American music.
Mm-hmm.
There is, I can't think, maybe classical, because that's a European form, but every other, and I wouldn't even count that as American music. That's something But every form of American music
has been filtered through African hands.
Yeah, it starts with us. I mean, like, you, if you go, let's say, ragtime with Scott Joplin, mm-hmm. that's us. If you go rock and roll with Rosetta Tharpe and Chuck Berry, that's us.
The blues,
Muddy Waters and Etta James, that's us. Jazz, gospel, Billie Holiday,
all of that.
Gospel, you know, R&B, hip hop, mm-hmm. club, dance, you know, house.
All of that.
All of that is us. Soul. Ballroom is us. Mm-hmm. Like, everything is us.
Country music.
All of it. You're welcome. Like, we did that shit. Like, now, the country has been very effective at making it difficult for us to monetize off of that creativity and intellectual
property. But shout out to the people who took the time to understand, again, you know, having the outtakes on that Solange album by Master P really broke it down. A lot of artists who wanted to experienced wealth and not just fame in the last 25 years, quickly it's become that, are looking at this entrepreneurship model that was really, it wasn't started by the artist Master P, but it was really, really, really amplified by him because he did it even without the music machine that was already set up mm-hmm. for black music. And his whole thing was, I want to control what comes out and I want to get paid from it. So now you have wealthier musicians because they paid attention to who gets paid off of my labor. So if it weren't for the many black acts that came out where they were just used and abused, for lack of a better term, you see, they come out, they're singing the song, the album comes out, and all of a sudden it's a cover, mm-hmm. you know, by a white group, or the cover of the album is just, you know, of a scene or white people, so that people wouldn't know who was singing on the track, you know, these terrible contracts. This is just an example of, you know, pay me for what I really do. And even that energy has gone to where we are. So that energy is present in sports, where you have LeBron James picking up the phone and counseling people on how to finesse their rookie contracts until it's really time to get paid, because he doesn't want to see you without your wealth for what you know you're actually doing, because it used to be your agents. Your agents are going to get paid, the owners are getting paid, you know, the coach is getting paid. Yeah. Why are you broke? But when you really think about that, like, oh, who's making money off my jersey? Who's making money off my image? So it's not only the fact that we continue to show up in certain industries in certain ways, but it's also the idea of we're bringing that business sense that has always been there. Always been there. People be like, oh, black, or why don't more black people start businesses? And I'm like, y'all don't really read, because we've been having these businesses and these economic engines, and the structure sometimes gets so agitated by the fact that we are locking them out of dollars that it retaliates. You gotta understand the other side to what we're saying when you're talking about retaining black wealth in black hands.
Speaking of agitate, I want to talk about slang. So black people, if we go back to slavery, where we've been forced to invent language or wield language in a way mm-hmm. that was coded, and where we still were able to effectively communicate with each other, mm-hmm. that was a survival skill, so that, you know, we're not getting maimed or lynched because murdered because this message that was not intended for that audience got to that audience. Mm-hmm. And so we became really good at coding our language, and that is always pushing the boundaries of slang. And so the agitation comes in when some of that slang makes it into popular culture, because mm-hmm. it's like, what? Wait, no. let's reinvent. It's time to move. It's time to evolve. And so that retaining that element of the culture means we're always propelling the language forward. Mm-hmm. We're always on that bleeding edge of what's, you know what I'm saying, what's cool, you know what I'm saying, what are we saying? And I love that. I mean, I love that. Yeah, but that you really got to be connected to the community to know what these words mean. Mm-hmm. Like, if you out of step, then you got to look
it'll
it up.
Show.
You got to figure it out. And then by the time it makes it to mainstream, we already on something else.
Right.
And it's frustrating, because you're like, why are you using that?
We're not social using media anymore. Hasn't even killed that. Like, it is definitely put it under the lens that's exactly what's happening, that we have language and then that language is co-opted mm-hmm. by the mainstream. But social media hasn't quite killed it, which is why sometimes I love the comment sections, because I love to see what language people are using to express themselves. And I don't always feel compelled to use mm-hmm. you know, those same words, but it comes from marginalized sections where, again, we've learned how to communicate so that we understand what we're talking about, because we're not talking to you. But I think that there's beauty in words. You know, you write poetry, you always want to make a word, you want to turn it inside out. So I like to see people turning words inside out in ways that I wouldn't have ever thought to do. I mean, it's a endless source of creativity.
Yeah, the equivalent is you going to get your manicure, pedicure, or whatever, and the people who own the shop, who are not black, who may be Asian, they start to talk in a language that's theirs. Mm-hmm. And some people get frustrated because they can't understand it. But that's not their problem. Like, they're just doing what they do. Right. We were cut off from the language that was ours. Mm-hmm. And so we invented a language that was ours. And it just happens to be wrapped in English. But we freaked that in a different way. Right. And so,
and we made other things our language. Like we said, we made our music a language. Yeah. We made our dancing a language. We made, I mean, we just... I don't know.
We dope as fuck.
I mean, for real. I'm trying to be humble.
Yeah, I know. It's Black History Month. That's what we're here for.
I mean, whatever. Every month. Every month that I make it to, we finna celebrate all things. All
right. So the other thing that Black people do really well is Black people in America act as a mirror to America to remind America that we have not yet lived up to our ideals. That we have.
So we good at getting on America's nerves.
Yeah, that's okay. What we do. We resist. We stand up. We protest. We say, yup, this is what you said.
And they've known the whole time that that's how it was going to be.
Yeah.
This is not a surprise to anybody.
I love that I hate that we're in that position.
Right.
But that's just part of the culture. Is like we've had to, from the beginning, mm-hmm. remind you that we're not there yet. I mean, and we still here because
no
we believe.
No matter what you're talking about.
Yeah, we believe that we can get there. Mm-hmm. But we need to get there.
Right.
And until we're, you know what I'm saying?
Until you take us, you won't be there.
Right. So we're going to sit here and remind you.
That you are not who you think you are.
All right. So, Black Joy. We kind of touched on some of this, but there's a lot of ethos wrapped around this. Okay. This term, Black Joy. One of the ways that I see it displayed is in the ability to find humor in maybe things that are not funny,
that
wouldn't normally be funny, or the ability to laugh right. during a traumatic situation, right. or to just find that nugget of joy, to be able to mine that and say, all right, this is a really fucked up situation. Mm-hmm.
But that over there,
what you got? What are those? Mm. Like, what are you wearing? Why did you come to the hospital dressed like that? Like, we are the worst, but we need that with each other.
Oh my goodness!
So yeah, I mean, that's mine and the joys out of little things, like mm-hmm. Whether that's like good light for a selfie or a smiling child, or free before 10, whatever it is.
Listen.
Free before
10 and or free snacks.
Find a way to be, find a reason to be happy.
2 for 1. Hallelujah.
Because if we're not doing that, then we're going to be doing the other thing. So, yeah, you take these jokes and.
Woo.
Or these hands. Right. Or these hands.
One or the other, or both, if you're feeling fry. I just want to say that Black people love their children. I think that, you know, for all the images you might see of us not doing that, it's a lot of Black joy rooted in our kids, mm-hmm. rooted in not only, you know, carrying our kids and actually giving birth. I think that, you know, just like we talked about the trauma over years, over generations of forced separations, something about having your child with you. And I've seen people put so much pride in their children and go to bat for their kids and advocate for their kids. So I see our children as a huge source of our joy. I love to see them, and I love to see our kids light up when they realize they're being loved on. You know, you can't assume that any child of any background is receiving enough love. Mm. But I will always think that Black children need just a little bit more for the world that we're preparing them for. So again, you know, I think about the examples within my family. I think about what I, you know, strive to be to other people. I want to be a source of love because I know that just knowing that somebody loves you, you know, kind of can bridge the gap for you, can get you where you're going. Remembering, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like you plant seeds so that when people are not there, you remember. You know, I have seeds that are still sprouting in my life because I remember that people love me. You understand what I'm saying? So that's a huge source of that joy. And I love how we compliment one another. I love that, again, you get a bad rap, but my biggest and most beautiful compliments come from Black women. Mm-hmm. Who we have found so many ways to say, you look good. I see you shining. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm trying to get like you. I love your fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. And it's not, oh my gosh, I love your earrings. It's not that. You know, it might be that in a certain environment because yeah. that's kind of switchy, right? Mm-hmm. But if you hear that, I love it. Your earrings are everything.
Yeah.
You know, your hair is working today. You know, because you never know what somebody is experiencing or what they're going through. You know, I started wearing my hair natural at my place of employment, and I don't think I really thought twice about it. I don't think I thought that it was, you know, revolutionary or anything like that. It's my hair. Yeah. But I love when other people, other sisters, older sisters are like, Your curls are popping. Oh, okay, I see. Maybe they didn't have that option. And when they affirm me in that way, I'm like, today's a good day. And I try to give that to, you know, a younger person who might not be sure. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Young people sometimes, like I said, they lead. They are more sure than some of us adults. But I try to plant that with younger people so that they'll know kind words, you know, enthusiasm. You never know what you're doing for somebody else, and I don't think anybody does it like we do.
Yeah, you know what, I feel I get excited when I see somebody who like got big curly hair. It's like big curly natural, and not that that's the best thing, but I know that that's far along a journey that mm-hmm. they took. It may have started with a big chop or whatever, and yeah. now they got this huge mane of hair that's awesome, and the thing is just bouncing, and they turn, and I'm like, oh, that shit looks awesome. Now I don't say it all the time because yeah. Black men has done so much harm with just walking up to people giving but in my heart I'm just rooting
yeah,
for them. I'm like,
yo,
that shit is crazy.
Hey, your hair look nice.
Yeah,
but it's an accomplishment. You know, that person's been patient.
I'm like rooting. Yeah. I'm like, yo, you did it. Like, yeah. This joint is awesome. And this, before we get out of here, I just want to, I feel like we're living in this period of history that's a little bit different. So we talked about at the head of the show some of the Black women that did not get their shine. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the history books will look back on this period as the Black girl magic era, where Black women will be represented up front. And I don't know if that's because, I mean, I don't know where it'll start. If mm-hmm. it'll start at the crack epidemic where men were out of the home and Black women were raising mm-hmm. many people, mm-hmm. Or, you know, becoming highly educated or higher educated mm-hmm. than Black men in the communities, and that's leading to things. That's leading to more mm-hmm. political appointments and more things like that. And I think if we step away from this period and look over that arc, we'll see women stepping into that leadership position mm-hmm. that they've been leading in for decades. And
for generations.
Yeah, for generations. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. what I'm saying. So Black women have been leading without the accolades or the attention.
Yeah.
And recently, since the 80s, it's almost being forced into a position of leadership, but that leadership has not been acknowledged, but we're starting to see the fruits of it.
Yeah, so, I feel like we're right there.
So like how can you not have like Black women leading in churches when they've been raising the people that's in the churches for all this time? Like
it's so egregious.
They're qualified to lead. They got higher degrees than you. They got like, so
it's
so
really
what I'm saying
serious.
Is in history, as history looks on our time right now, I'm hoping that it looks favorably on Black women finally.
It will.
So
I don't think we gonna have it any other way. And it's so we'll get into this more, mm-hmm. but I feel like what is happening is that our strength cannot be denied. So however it's been trying to be repressed, however it has been derailed or diffused at this particular stage, this is the flowering of the plant that has already been seeded. Yeah. So, you know, the black women who are attempting to lead politically, the black women who are leading in business organizations, leading and participating, the people who are like, you know what, society might see me one way, but here's the data that I'm producing that I'm a different way. It's coming into maturation that it can actually be seen with the naked eye. Everybody loves data. Everybody loves social media. So it only takes, you know, 2 days after the vote for you to see who was looking out for everybody. Right. You see what I mean? And it as far as even this, the slang culture, the imagery, people want they want everything. The body. It used to just be the lips, y'all. Now it's everything. It's the whole thing.
Even the skin, the thing that they.
And really, the trade-off is we want ourselves. So that's what's magical. It's not so much, you know, oh, they want this while you're also selling to me that I should not want it. We want it. We want to own that imagery, and we're proud of ourselves, and that in and of itself is powerful. This is what a time to be alive.
So it's Black History Month, y'all. We want to celebrate us because we love us.
We love us.
Black resilience, black culture. This is us for Faith Uncut. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.